Hello and welcome to Subject to Change with me, Russell Hawk. My guest today is Professor Barry Strauss of Cornell University. Barry is one of America's leading historians of the ancient world and particularly its military history. Barry has written numerous books on the subject, and today we're going to talk about one of these books, The War That Made the Roman Empire. So welcome, Barry, to the podcast.
Thank you, Russell. It's a pleasure to be here.
I should just mention, in addition to your books, you also host the excellent podcast called Antiquitas, and I'll link that in the show notes, because I think if listeners enjoy ancient history, then I really, really recommend the podcast.
Thank you.
So let's get back to the war that made the Roman Republic. And this is the war between Octavian, who confusingly is later called Augustus, and that's on one side. And then on the other side, we have the most famous couple in the history of the world, and that is Antony and Cleopatra. And, you know, like a lot of history, it's quite hard to know exactly where to start the story. But my thought was, could we go back to Julius Caesar? Because all the characters have a claim that in some sense they are Caesar's heir. Or if they're not his heir, then they're the mother of Caesar's heir, perhaps. So maybe we could just start with you saying a bit about the relationship of each of these characters with Julius Caesar.
Yes, indeed. Each of these characters was competing for the mantle of Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was a Roman noble who rose to the top of the political tree. And after winning a civil war, he became Rome's first and only dictator for life. He inspired so much opposition that he was assassinated in March of the year 44 BC. The famous Ides of March. And after his death, there were many claimants for primacy in Rome. On the side of Caesar, there was, first of all, his heir. In his will, Caesar posthumously adopted his great nephew, his sister's sister's son, an 18-year-old named Gaius Octavius, who accepted the adoption, changed his name to Gaius Julius Caesar. According to Roman convention, he should have been Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus. He never accepted that name, Octavianus. He always called himself Gaius Julius Caesar. That'd be very confusing. So most historians refer to him as Octavian. He announced that he wanted to have all the honors and hold all the offices that his adoptive father, Julius Caesar, had held. In other words, even though he was only 18, he wanted to be the leading man in Rome. But there were others who stood in his way. There were, first of all, the assassins of Caesar, Brutus and Cassius, and the senators who supported them. But there was also one of Caesar's main collaborators, one of his military lieutenants, Marcus Antonius, who we call Mark Antony. Mark Antony might have been disappointed that he wasn't recognized in Caesar's will. But as far as he was concerned, he deserved to be Caesar's heir. He was in the prime of life. He was in his 40s, unlike young Octavian. And he had proven himself on the battlefield. He also was one of Rome's two consuls at the time of Caesar's death. And he was a full-blooded Roman aristocrat. Octavian was a Roman aristocrat on his mother's side. But his father's side was not part of the Roman aristocracy. They were a wealthy family from Italy, but not in the nobility. And full nobles like Antony would look down on Octavian. So Antony and Octavian were rivals. And in fact, they went to war within a year or so of Caesar's death. Antony would go on to be connected to the most powerful woman in his world, and that is Cleopatra, who was the queen of Egypt. Egypt, of course, was a great old kingdom in the Mediterranean. It was immensely wealthy. We might realize it now, but because of the annual flooding of the Nile, Egypt had some of the most fertile agricultural land in the Mediterranean. It was one of the breadbaskets of the Mediterranean world, and the dynasty that ruled Egypt had ruled it for three centuries. Cleopatra's dynasty, the Ptolemies, They were sitting on an enormous treasure in their capital city of Alexandria. They also had a great military and naval tradition. They had fallen considerably from the height of their power, and they existed as an independent kingdom only at the sufferance of Rome. But as a result of that, the monarchs of Egypt were adept at diplomacy, and Cleopatra might have been the most cunning and astute of them all.
Well, she pretty much has to be, doesn't she? Because, you know, yes. living anywhere near the Romans at that time, I think I saw somebody somewhere say it's a bit like living quite close to the Nazis. You know, it's a very uncomfortable neighbor to have.
Yes. Well, the Romans weren't as bad as the Nazis.
No.
They weren't a neighbor that you wanted to have. And Cleopatra was one of the monarchs of the world who was very good at holding off the Romans. She used all of the powers in her toolkit, all the tools in her toolkit. And one of them was her sex. And she had a relationship, an erotic relationship, first with Julius Caesar. She became his mistress. And not long after meeting Caesar, she became pregnant. And she gave birth to a son. Caesar never officially recognized the paternity, but he allowed her to name the son Ptolemy Caesar, which is good enough for me. And he's generally known by the nickname Caesarion. That's what we call him today.
That wasn't his actual name. I thought that was his actual name.
No, his actual name is Ptolemy Caesar. Caesarion or Caesarion in Greek is a nickname that the people of Alexandria gave him. It's a pun or like an Alexandrian joke on Latin to call him Caesarion. But Caesar is assassinated, and Cleopatra next becomes the mistress of Mark Antony.
Just before we get on to that, I just want to, because you've written the book about the death of Caesar, so I just want to ask you a little bit about the death of Caesar, because what is he thinking about? It's March 44 BC. I don't know if it's the day before he's off to his army, but it must be, you know, days before he's off to his army.
Yes.
What is he thinking going to the Senate without a bodyguard when he's in reach of getting back to what he loves doing? He's away from this sort of, you know, the Roman senators who are all this trouble they cause him, how difficult they are, and he's going to be back with his army. He's going to be free again to do what he loves best. And he risks it all. So what was going on?
Julius Caesar was a risk addict. He loved risk. And throughout his career, he takes risks. They tend to be strategic risks. He won't blindly take a risk. But I guess he felt, who would be crazy enough to assassinate me? Rome has just had a civil war that lasted for 4 years. Who would want to unleash the dogs of war again?
Mm.
No one would be that crazy. He'd certainly gotten many warnings of assassinations, but at this point, he had so many of these warnings, and they turned out to be false alarms, that it was kind of like background noise. And he was quite arrogant as well.
Yeah.
He almost doesn't go to the Senate meeting. His wife, who is the daughter of a prominent politician, she's a member of the nobility, the political class, she gets wind that there's a plot against him, and she's really concerned about it. She gets him to agree not to go to the Senate meeting, and the conspirators, who are horrified by this, send one of their number who is very close to Caesar, and he talks Caesar into it. If we believe the sources, he uses the macho argument. You know, if you don't go to the Senate meeting, how can you really hold up your head as a man if you were afraid to go to the Senate meeting here in Rome? So he goes.
Mm. And he's sort of been holding the state sort of in a frozen stasis, if you like.
Right.
And then as soon as he dies, just all the forces are unleashed in all directions. Is that a fair?
That's absolutely fair. So the conspirators, the assassins, believed that they could restore the Republic to what it had been only a few years before, if they could only get rid of Caesar, who they saw as the big problem. But they did not reckon on the power of Caesar's remaining supporters. And nor did they understand what they needed to do to win over Caesar's troops. What they needed to do to win over Caesar's troops was basically to give them a pay raise, to come up with the money to pay them. And they didn't really have that money, and they didn't want to dip into their own pockets. So they tried to get victory on the cheap, and it didn't work. Caesar's soldiers wouldn't hear of it.
And how do, because you mentioned this earlier, how does Antony and Octavian, who's, well, I guess he's the heir, but he's got no legal position in the state. Antony's the consul. How on earth do they end up at war with each other?
So the Roman Senate would assign magistrates provinces to govern after their year in office. Antony disputed the province that had been assigned to one of the assassins, a man named Decimus Brutus, not to be confused with the more famous Marcus Brutus. They were distant cousins. Decimus had been assigned northern Italy, which the Romans called Cisalpine Gaul. Gaul on this side of the Alps was technically not part of Italy. And Antony marched there to go to war against Decimus Brutus. Octavian had come back to Italy from abroad. He had been with Caesar's army in the east at the time of the assassination. He was actually in what is nowadays Albania. And Octavian portrays himself as a defender of the Republic and a friend of the Senate. And he gets he bribes some of the soldiers to join him. He raises a private army and he gets them to join him, first because his name is now Caesar, and secondly because he gives them a pay raise. He understands how things work. And the Senate votes to allow him to join the senatorial armies to march off to Gaul to fight against Antony, who, as far as they're concerned, has illegally tried to take control of this province.
Okay.
Octavian and the two consuls who go to Gaul to fight Antony are successful. They defeat him. Now, the two consuls actually die as a result of wounds in battle. The rumor is that one of them is poisoned by Octavian. We'll never know if that's true or not.
I always think in ancient history, whenever somebody dies, you know, inconveniently, well, it's always poison. And I do it rather wonder. It may well be. I don't know.
You just don't know. It's plausible, but who knows? So Octavian's the last man left standing. Antony, one of the things about Mark Antony is that he's always best in retreat. And he leads his army in a heroic retreat across the Alps to southern France, to Gaul. And there, where there's a huge concentration of Roman legions, he convinces the legions to join him. And he convinces one of Caesar's important remaining allies, Marcus Lepidus, to join him. So Antony and Lepidus now have a lot of legions behind them. And they're prepared to go south across the Alps back into Italy. And now Octavian says, on second thought, let's become allies.
Yeah. And Antony, biggest mistake of his career, he says, that's a good idea.
Yeah. So in November of 43, they meet at in Bologna, right outside of Bologna, and they form a conspiracy to control the state. It's called the Second Triumvirate. And they march on Rome. They take the city. And these guys are now effectively in charge of Rome. The Senate still exists, but they're really calling the shots. And unlike Julius Caesar, who famously had shown clemency to most of his opponents in the Civil War, he pardoned them. They don't show clemency. They announce a purge, and they put a price on the head of many members of the Roman nobility, all their political enemies, most of whom flee to safety outside of Italy. Their property is confiscated, and the money is turned over to the triumvirs, who need it to go to war against the remaining assassins, who are now in the east raising money and raising an army of their own. One of the people who had been purged who's not lucky enough to escape is Cicero, and he is famously murdered shortly after this at the behest of the triumvirs.
And I believe they cut out his tongue and nail it to a door somewhere.
Yeah, and his hands they nail to the rostra in the Roman Forum. Yeah.
Huh. On the one hand, I feel sorry for Cicero. On the other hand, I feel like he's a man who might actually, had he been a bit more helpful to Caesar, you know, might have managed to save something from the wreckage. And then, you know, when he's supposed to be fleeing from the triumvirs, you know, he goes first one way, then another way, then he gets into a boat, and then he comes back off the boat. And you think, you're not doing this running away thing, you know, just quite as well as you could be.
I certainly pity him having to end his life in this way after a pretty heroic career.
Yeah. So the triumvirs, and it's a legal triumvirate, isn't it? They've actually, because the old triumvirate, the first triumvirate, that was Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus, and that was just an informal arrangement. But here they've actually got legal. They've got legal powers. They've raised legal armies, and they go off and to fight the assassins.
Yes, they do.
So how does that turn out for them?
Well, they defeat the assassins. They meet the assassins in northeastern Greece, outside the city of Philippi. In principle, the assassins should have won. They had a terrific army. One of their generals, Cassius, was an excellent commander, one of Rome's best. They also had a navy. They controlled the sea. But they fail in spite of it because they take the bait of fighting Antony instead of staying behind their fortifications and starving the enemy army out. Mm. Antony is a good general, and he defeats one wing of the army, but Cassius mistakenly thinks that he has been thoroughly beaten by Antony, which is not true, and so he falls on his sword. The army of the conspirators, the assassins, they call themselves the liberators. Their army survives. But now the person in charge of it is Marcus Brutus, who is not a good general. He's not a military man at all. And shortly afterwards, there follows a second battle in which they're thoroughly defeated. And Brutus also commits suicide. And now Antony and Octavian. Octavian hasn't really taken much of a part in the fighting. It's really Antony's victory. They're now in command, in sole command of the Roman Empire.
They divide the empire between them, as I understand it. Antony goes east.
Yes.
He keeps Gaul, which is a very good idea, because you want to keep somebody sort of looking over the shoulder of Octavian, who's given, apart from Gaul, he's given the west. I mean, it's a monstrous thing they've done, though, to divide it up like this. This is, you know, they've just stolen the Republic between them. It seems extraordinary.
Yes, indeed. But from their point of view, the Republic had shown that it was a hollow shell. You know, there had been a very bloody civil war between Caesar and Pompey, and after Pompey's death, Pompey's other supporters. And then when Caesar had attempted to restore a kind of order, he had been assassinated in turn, and there was a return to war. I think from Octavian's point of view, it was personal. He was avenging his father as he saw it. Antony, it was somewhat less personal, but I expect that both men thought that, at least for the time being, the Republic needed strong men to guide it. Antony felt that he had a job to do. His job was to make order out of the chaos on Rome's eastern border. Most of the eastern Mediterranean had only been conquered in the 60s by Pompey. And it was rather disorganized. There were a series of client kings, and Rome wasn't really sure that it would be able to maintain its order there. In fact, only a few years earlier, in the year 40, Parthians, Rome's only surviving peer competitor, the Parthian Empire, they'd invaded Syria and Judea. And they didn't stop rulers for a time. So it wasn't at all clear that Rome was in charge. Excuse me, I've gotten the chronology wrong. That was about to happen. It hadn't happened yet in the year 42. So we're in the year 42. Parthia's on the rise. It's not at all clear that Rome's going to keep control of the Eastern Mediterranean. And more important, as far as Antony's concerned, is actually invading Parthian territory, avenging the defeat of Marcus Crassus back in 53 at the Battle of Carrhae, and fulfilling the mission that Julius Caesar was about to go on to when he was assassinated in 44. So from Antony's point of view, he's got to do that in the East. From Octavian's point of view, in the West, he's got to, A, settle the veterans of the war against the conspirators, and B, deal with the problem of Sextus Pompey. Sextus Pompey is the son of Pompey the Great, and in the chaos following the assassination of Julius Caesar, he had created for himself a naval empire, or naval kingdom, if you will, based in Sicily. And the Republic had to restore its control of Sicily, Sardinia, Corsica, the islands that Sextus Pompey controlled. And Sextus Pompey also was able to raid the coast of Italy at will. Furthermore, I think that Octavian was already thinking that it was his job to renovate the Republic as they would have thought of it. I don't think any of these people thought that they were going to replace the Roman Republic and put up a new signboard that says, we're now the empire.
Mm-hmm.
Octavian, when he called himself Augustus, always said that he was restoring the Republic. And I think in some sense, he really believed it. He could imagine himself reconstituting the Republic, making it better again. Of course, it was very different from what it had been.
Mm. So Antony's out east, and I guess he needs to get the money, he needs to get the troops, he needs to get the client, right. The client kingdoms on his side so that he can sort out the Parthians, well, I don't know, once and for all, maybe not once and for all, I don't know what his ambitions are, but the place he can get all this power, all this money, is one Cleopatra?
She's certainly a very important piece of the puzzle. Of course, there were taxes to be raised in the East, and because the East was very wealthy. And there were legions. Antony controlled legions in the East, but Cleopatra could greatly add to his wealth. And also, she was the mistress of Julius Caesar. So if he were to have an affair with Cleopatra, that would add to his prestige and give him a claim to the mantle of Caesar. So very appealing to connect with her in many ways, not to mention her own native charms.
I wonder, how did he feel about Caesarion? I wonder, do we know?
We don't know, but he was always supportive of him. I think that he understood that Caesarion was a net plus for Antony, yeah. because it gave Cleopatra and the House of Cleopatra a certain legitimacy in the veins of her son flowed the blood of Ptolemy, Alexander's lieutenant, and Julius Caesar. It's pretty good.
Yeah. And so, okay, so Antony, this is great. His opponent is bogged down with all sorts of troubles in Italy. He's got this impossible war with Sextus Pompey. It's a disaster for Octavian, clearly. Antony's got this great opportunity. He's got this powerful Roman army. He's going to invade Parthia. It's hard to see what could really go wrong for him.
Well, of course, the problem is that invading Parthia is easier said than done. Parthia is a very effective fighter. And Antony turns out to be not as great a general as he thought he was.
So what goes wrong for him?
Well, he invades what is now northwestern Iran. He invades it from Armenia, which in antiquity was a much larger kingdom than the modern country of Armenia. And the king of Armenia turned out to be a not entirely trustworthy ally. Nothing wrong with that. Rome doesn't have any claim to tell the Armenians what to do. And the Parthians are a lot shrewder than Antony. Antony hurries ahead, leaving behind him his supply train and his siege train, which he's going to need if he wants to lay siege to and capture the capital city of this area, which is a city called Pharaspa. We don't know exactly where it is. And while Antony is hurrying ahead, the Parthians go in his rear and they destroy his siege train. So now Antony is parked in front of Pharaspa, and he can't lay siege to it because he doesn't have the equipment he needs. You might think, well, why doesn't he just build new siege equipment? Because there aren't trees there that he could use to do that. So he's stuck. And after making a a display of his power, he has no choice except to return home. It's late enough in the season that at this point he has to go through some icy-covered mountain roads, and the king of Armenia decides that he's not going to help Antony. He's going to turn his back on his Roman ally because he lives in Parthia's neighborhood and he sees that Parthia is winning the war. Romans come and go. So Antony once again has to show that he's the master of retreats and he's very good at retreats. He heroically brings most of his army through these hills, being constantly sniped at and attacked by the Parthian enemy, and finally makes his way back to the Mediterranean coast, where he has called for Cleopatra to come help him and bail him out, which she does. And then he goes back to Egypt to lick his wounds and to rebuild.
I get a bit confused with the order of events here.
Sure.
At this stage, because Octavian is making a better job in the West, but there's been sort of trouble. There's been rebellions in the West. Can you just help me out with the chronology here? Because Antony, I think he reinvades Armenia successfully a year or two later. So he kind of bounces back a bit. But in the West, what's going on?
Well, first, Octavian had to deal with a rebellion in central Italy. So he had these tens of thousands of veterans to settle. And they wanted to land in Italy. They didn't want to go to the provinces. And there wasn't enough empty land in Italy to give them. So the only way to get them land was to kick other people off their land, those who backed the wrong horse in previous politics. And those people rebel. There is a war centered on the Umbrian city of Perusia, modern Perugia. And suspiciously enough, Antony's brother and his wife, Fulvia, are leading the charge against Octavian. Antony himself has plausible deniability. He's in the East and he says, I don't have anything to do with this.
He might actually be quite appalled because there's no point in fighting Octavian unless you're going to win.
Exactly. So Octavian does win. Antony comes to Italy with a fleet and it looks like Antony and Octavian are going to come to blows. But in the year 40, they decide to make a truce, to make an agreement. And the symbol of the agreement is Octavian's sister, young Octavia. She's actually slightly older than Octavian. She is a widow, and Antony has become a widower. His Roman wife has died. And so an alliance is arranged via a marriage between Antony and Octavia. This is a very Roman way of doing business. They're married, and Antony and Octavian agree that they will not go to war. They will settle all their disputes, and Antony will go back to the East, this time with Octavia along with him as his wife. And Antony gives ships to Octavian to use against Sextus Pompey. Octavian promises to send troops to Antony, but he never does send very many of those troops. So Octavian gets the better of the bargain.
As he so often did. So Antony's married Octavia.
Yes.
But he's still very much involved with Cleopatra. So, but does Octavia accompany Antony to Egypt? I mean, how?
To Athens. Their base is Athens.
Does Antony not go? Is that when Antony goes back out east and takes on the Armenians?
Yes, he takes on the Parthians and the Armenians. Antony had no qualms about being married to a Roman woman. And having his Egyptian wife or mistress, we don't know if they were legally married, or even if the queen of Egypt needed to be legally married, since the Egyptians considered her a goddess on earth. Not clear that she needed to be married. But yes, for a while, Octavia's in Athens, and then Antony sends her back to Italy, where she lives in his house in Rome.
Is it about this stage that we have these famous donations of Alexandria? They celebrate this triumph, don't they, over Armenia, but they probably throw in the Parthians for good luck.
Yeah.
And they celebrate that in Alexandria, which is a fairly shocking thing to do because it's a Roman triumph. It should be celebrated in Rome, but it's celebrated in Alexandria. And then you have I mean, it sounds like it should be a forgery, the donations of Alexandria, but it's not, right?
First of all, that triumph is not quite all that shocking because the Ptolemies had carried out triumphs of their own. It would be different than a Roman triumph, but they would have parades celebrating victories. So from the Ptolemaic point of view, it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. The donations of Alexandria are a ceremony in which Antony recognizes the kingdoms that the children of Cleopatra will have. He has three children by Cleopatra, two sons and a daughter, plus Cleopatra has Caesarion by Julius Caesar, and recognizes that Caesarion is the legitimate heir of Julius Caesar and will become king of Egypt. He already is king of Egypt. Technically, Cleopatra is co-ruler with her son Caesarion, Ptolemy XV. And the three children will each get a kingdom in the east. Now, Octavian says this is really shocking and Antony is giving away the Roman store. But in fact, it is not unusual for the Romans to move provinces around and put client kings in charge of them. They had done just that with Cyprus for a while. So it's not nearly as shocking as Octavian's propagandists make it out to be.
But isn't the shocking thing that it's Antony's children that have been given these client kingdoms? Because that's never happened before in Roman history, I don't think.
It is it's a novelty. Yes, children have never been given client kingdoms before. So that is new. And what's got to be really disturbing for Antony and many in the Senate, well, not everyone, excuse me, really disturbing for Octavian and many in the Senate, is that Antony has done what the Romans had tried to avoid doing up to now. The Romans did not want to let any one man be in charge of Egypt. And now Antony is the one Roman who, in effect, controls Egypt and all of its wealth. And that's got to bother
Why are they moving towards war? Is this the point at which war is now inevitable and they're just trying to sort of maneuver for position? What starts the ball rolling down the slope?
Antony has certainly been protecting himself by building a navy, a great navy, state-of-the-art navy. But he's not eager to go to war against Octavian. Antony has been rebuilding his army. As you said, he took Armenia. And he's planning to go back to war against Parthia. He wants to reopen this campaign, now wiser. But it can't happen because Octavian declares war against Antony. Well, he doesn't actually declare war against Antony. In effect, he declares war against Antony. But famously, he declares war only against Cleopatra, which is outrageous. Cleopatra's a Roman ally. She's done nothing against Rome, except to support Antony rather than Octavian. But Octavian declares that Cleopatra has been plotting against Rome and she has been corrupting this noble Roman general, Mark Antony, and turning him into her boy toy. He's no longer a manly Roman, but he's now a decadent Egyptian who sleeps under mosquito nets, as no good Roman ever would.
That is shocking.
Yeah, right.
So poor old Antony, he's now in an impossible position. He has to defend his ally, right?
Yeah, I don't know if it's an impossible position. He thinks he has a good chance of winning. He's got a great navy, and he has rebuilt his army, and he has many client kingdoms in the east, client kings who will support him. He thinks he's going to be able to win this war.
Okay, so what's his strategy then? How does he plan to bring Octavian to defeat?
Yeah. Good question. He does the right thing and the wrong thing. The right thing is that he gathers his forces and he moves them westward. He moves them westward to near the demarcation line of the two empires in northwestern Greece and what is now southern Albania. I think he should have then invaded, crossed the straits and invaded Italy and tried to take either Brundisium or Tarentum, Brindisi or Taranto. Not an easy thing to do. They are both heavily fortified cities, but Antony has the kind of navy that includes ships that are basically bunker busters, if you will. Mm. It's an anachronistic term. They wouldn't bust bunkers, but they would break their way in through fortified harbors and give Antony a chance of taking these two places. He could then march with his armies on Rome. And I think that he had a really good chance of shocking the enemy and winning the war. But he doesn't do that. Instead, he decides to stay on the defensive in Western Greece and wait for the enemy to come to him. No doubt expecting that he could then force a battle against the enemy, possibly a sea battle, but better yet, a land battle, where Antony felt more at home in his element, and defeat him there. So that is the strategy. Why he doesn't invade Italy, we don't know. It may be because he's decided it's too politically incorrect to invade the Queen of Egypt in tow. It may be because he's lost his nerve after his bad experience against Parthia. It may be because his paymaster, Queen Cleopatra, who insists on being present with him, is opposed to it because she wants to guard the sea lanes to Egypt, or because she fears that, indeed, she will be too much of a propaganda burden on Antony if he invades Italy. But in any case, the invasion never comes off.
I mean, certainly, you can maybe say a bit more about the fact that Cleopatra is with the army, but to the extent that this is being presented as a war against Cleopatra, they've kind of playing into the hands of that propaganda by having Cleopatra right there in the army. And if they took her over to invade Italy, I mean, that would be a disaster. Well, from propagandistic point of view.
Well, it wouldn't have been good for the propagandistic point of view, but my own feeling is that if Antony had won on the battlefield, he could have talked his way out of it.
Yeah.
I don't think that Cleopatra was a complete deal breaker. Maybe I'm being too naive about Roman prejudices against both women and Easterners. I think he could have talked his way out of it. But certainly there were some of his Roman allies felt that they wanted him to send Cleopatra back to Egypt. She refused to go because she didn't trust Antony and she didn't trust Octavian. She knew that the minute she left, Octavian would try to patch up his dispute with Antony. Antony had divorced Octavian in the early months of the war. Some might consider that an own goal, because certainly not endear him to the Italians that he had divorced his Roman wife. On the other hand, it was what the political scientists call a credible commitment. It showed that he was all in supporting Cleopatra.
Mm.
Perhaps he would now have taken her back. That's what Cleopatra feared. So she wasn't about to leave this expedition. Besides which, she's a Ptolemy. And she feels that she has a reputation to uphold, that Ptolemaic monarchs were warrior kings. She wanted to go back to the glory days of the early Ptolemaic monarchy. And even though she was a woman, she felt that she had to show that she was defending the monarchy and all that it stood for. So she had good reasons to be there.
And maybe she thought she was the smarter of the two of them and that her advice might not go amiss.
Absolutely.
And the comparison I sort of make between Antony, for Antony is with Julius Caesar, because when he chases Pompey across the Adriatic, he's right. Prepared to invade even with just half his forces.
That's right. Yes.
And actually it's Antony who's stuck on the other side dithering about taking them over. And, yes. And there's kind of this mirror image of the two generals, and you can see the difference.
If you ask what Julius Caesar would have done had he been in Antony's shoes or Antony's sandals, I'm confident that he would have invaded Italy. Julius Caesar was a risk taker. There's no way he's going to sit and wait for the enemy to come. I think that gives us the measure of Antony, that he is sitting there and waiting. It's a totally un-Caesarian move.
Again, I just get the chronology a little bit mixed up, but it's at this stage while he's waiting in Greece, where he sort of positioned himself in Greece, that you think that the key moment of the war takes place. Is that right?
Antony and Cleopatra are wintering in western Greece, in the city of Patrae, modern Patras, northwestern Peloponnesus, when in approximately March of the year 31, Octavian's right-hand man, his best commander, in fact, a better commander than Octavian, Agrippa, Marcus Agrippa, takes a significant portion of Octavian's fleet, sails across the Ionian Sea, not the safest time of year to sail, and takes by storm the strategic port of Methone in the southwestern corner of the Peloponnesus. tremendously important because Antony and Cleopatra cannot feed their men with the resources of Greece. Greece is too poor a country to grow enough food to feed their army. So they have to bring in food from the east, from Egypt and Syria. It's a very long lifeline that stretches back there. Methone, because its harbor is so strategic and so good, it's an absolutely key link in the chain. And Agrippa takes it. He takes Methone by storming it by sea. We don't know exactly how he does it. The ancient sources are extremely stingy in what they tell us. But we know it's a famous feat that he carries this out. He takes the place and he kills the commander, who is the deposed king of Mauritania, a Moor named Bogud. And it's now in the hands of Agrippa. He uses it as a base, and he attacks the other supply ships that are bringing food to Antony and Cleopatra. And shortly after this, Octavian takes the rest of the fleet and crosses the Adriatic or the Ionian, and establishes himself just north of Actium. And Antony and Cleopatra hurriedly move the rest of their fleet there, move themselves there. And now the center of attention turns to northwestern Greece and to the Actium region.
Presumably, now his supply lines are, not just threatened, they've been, to some extent, sawn through. You know, the whole thing's been unzipped. So presumably, Antony now, he presumably is going to fight a battle with Octavian's army. But it doesn't really come to that. So why not?
So Antony's still getting supplies, but they have to take a much longer route to get there. They're constantly being harassed and cut off by the enemy. Antony wants to fight a land battle against Octavian, and he challenges him to come out and fight, but Octavian refuses because he knows he would be at a disadvantage. Antony tries to cut off Octavian's supplies, his access to water, but he fails at that as well. And Agrippa shows that he completely outclasses Octavian, Antony's admirals, and piece by piece he defeats squadrons of Antony's fleet. On top of that, so Antony's men are not being well fed, they're not getting enough food, and they're starting to get dysentery. They're getting sick, as ancient armies will, when they're stuck in camp month after month after month, especially because they're in an unhealthy place near the sea. They're probably also getting malaria because they're open to mosquitoes. Octavian's men are being supplied by sea. Octavian has command of the sea, and they also have the high ground, which means they're less at risk from malaria and mosquitoes than Antony's men are at sea level.
Can I just understand, because you said that this is something I always feel I need to have explained to me a bit, and given that you're a military historian, you're just the person.
Right.
By what right does Octavian refuse to fight? Why can't Antony force him to fight? I just don't quite understand how an army can say, and I hear this again and again, that they refused battle. And I'm thinking, well, is it their choice?
Sure. I mean, what can Antony do to him? He can try to cut off his supplies, and Antony tries to do that, but he fails.
Can he not attack Octavian's camp? I'm just trying to understand what's
it was fortified, so he has to get through the defenses. And Antony has an army, Octavian has an army, so he can defend the fortifications.
So basically, in ancient times, if you have a strong enough position, an army of the same size can't really force you to have a battle.
Not really. As long as you can maintain control of your men might get antsy. They also might get sick. You can't keep armies in the field forever, not in ancient time or any time. So there is a limit. And certainly Octavian is going to let the men out from time to time to go on raids of their own and attacks on their own. There can be attacks and counterattacks. Earlier on, Octavian challenges Antony's fleet to fight, but this is when only a portion of his fleet is at Actium, and that portion refuses the challenge. We know that we don't have all the details of the skirmishes that go on between the two sides. We get a hint in one source that Antony actually wins an engagement against Octavian, so it isn't all one-sided. But little by little, slowly by surely, Octavian is getting the upper hand. And one of the things that's happening is that Antony's allies start voting with their feet, and they start defecting to Octavian, which is a really big problem for Antony.
And again, there's sort of this mirror image with Julius Caesar, because Caesar, when he's trying to besiege, you know, the larger Pompeian army, and it doesn't work out, he realizes his strategy has gone wrong, and he marches his troops away.
Yeah.
And again, this was a puzzle to me, which I think your book kind of unlocked somewhat, is why Antony doesn't do the same thing. Once he realizes he can't force his battle, why he doesn't march his army away, because it just stays there and rots, doesn't it?
The two situations are not analogous. Caesar has no choice but to leave Dyrrhachium. He stays there as long as he can, but his men are defeated by Pompey, and he's in danger of being utterly destroyed unless he gets out of there fast, which is what he does. Antony doesn't feel that he's in that position. He's there for a few months, and he feels that it's just a matter of time before the enemy agrees to have a battle, before the enemy realizes he doesn't have as strong a base there as he does. It's a game of chicken. And where's he going to go? If Antony leaves, then Octavian isn't going to take control of Greece, maybe all of it, certainly this part of it. And Antony doesn't want to give that up. Furthermore, his men might desert him if he leaves, if he makes it clear that the enemy controls the field and he doesn't. So he has very good reason to stay.
So he stays. His army gets weaker because they don't have the supplies. They're getting sicker and sicker.
Right.
And now his choices are beginning to narrow down.
Right.
So what is his solution to the dilemma that he finds himself in?
The solution is to retreat, and he has to decide whether he's going to retreat by land or by sea or by both. And he decides to retreat by sea because he feels that retreating by land is much too difficult. Overland travel in the ancient world in general is more difficult, more expensive than naval travel. And he's not at all sure that he can get his army to march to a port in eastern Greece where he can get the remainder of his navy to ferry them back to safety in Egypt and points east. So he decides to retreat by sea. The other factor is that Cleopatra has with her a large part, if not all, of the Ptolemaic treasury. An enormous amount of wealth is with her. And she does not feel comfortable taking that on land. She doesn't have much of a land army with her at all. She's got 60 ships. She's got a navy. She's got marines. She trusts her security there. She doesn't trust her security on land. She is not leaving by land. She's leaving by sea. And so Antony has to decide what he is going to do. He also thinks that if he tries to leave by sea, one of two things will happen. Either the enemy will let him go and maybe try to chase him, or the enemy will insist on fighting a battle. And if the enemy insists on fighting a battle, it's not likely that Antony would win, but he still has a slight chance of winning. So there is a way to get out of this with honor. So that's a reason to go by sea as well. If he goes by land, the enemy's just going to harass him.
And he's got pretty good ships, hasn't he? I mean, he's got big warships. I mean, they're pretty formidable, as I understand it.
You know, at the end of the day, both navies are pretty similar in the ships they have. Both of them mostly have ships that are quadrimes and quinquiremes, 4 men to a room and 5 men to a room. But Antony does have a few of these super tankers, if you will, tens as they're called, ships that can be used to break through fortified harbors. Antony's ships also have reinforced prows. That means that they can engage in head-to-head ramming, and they will defeat the enemy. The enemy does not have ships with these reinforced prows, and Antony's ships will be better at that. The one disadvantage they have is that they're inexperienced. Octavian's fleet are the veterans of the battles that won the war against Sextus Pompey in Sicily. They've also engaged in a less formidable, less challenging war along the coast of what is nowadays Croatia and inland to what is nowadays Serbia. So they have a lot of experience, and experience in war should not be sneezed at. It's tremendously important. So they've got a veteran Navy, and Antony doesn't. Still, Antony had a few experienced commanders. He had Ahenobarbus and he had Sosius. Unfortunately for him, Ahenobarbus defects to the enemy not long before the battle. So that leaves him with Sosius as his best commander. Also, Antony, he started out with 500 warships. He's had to give up some of them to defend places along the route for the supplies, along the supply chain. He's lost some in battle to the enemy. And then he's forced to burn a significant part of the remainder of his fleet because he simply don't have the men to row the ships anymore. They're gone, either because of desertion or disease. So he's down to 230 warships at the time of the battle. Octavian has about 400 warships, so he greatly outnumbers Antony.
So how does the fight go? He decides he's got a dual strategy. He's gonna fight the battle, and if he can break through or if he's let through, then great. And if he can win the battle, also great.
Right. So Antony decides to leave Actium. At first, apparently Octavian says, "Well, we're going to let them go. You know, we'll just follow them. We're not going to fight them." Agrippa talks him out of it. Agrippa says, "We have to fight a battle. It's too risky to let them go. They can regroup somewhere else." And so they decide to fight a battle. When Antony and Cleopatra see what's what, they decide they will fight. Before the battle, they've done the unusual thing of loading their masts and their sails on their ships. Why is that unusual? Because normally ancient warships take their sails down and they take their masts off the ship before they fight to make the ships as light as possible so they can maneuver as much as possible during the battle and ram the enemy amidships rather than head-to-head. Amidships is less risky, or simply to be able to move or to attack the enemy head-to-head and to be disencumbered when they charge. So these battles will begin with a charge, and you want to be able to get up to as fast a speed as possible to have the most momentum when you smash into the enemy. So you want your ships to be light. Antony and Cleopatra's ships are not going to be that light. They're carrying their sails and their masts. So why? Why do they carry their sails and their masts? Because they realize that the chance of winning the battle is slim, or at best, risky. And they want to be able to escape. They feel that they will be better positioned to escape than their enemy if they've got their sails. Their enemy will not have his sails. They'll just have taken them off and left them on shore. Why do they want their sails? Because they know that every afternoon in this part of the world, regularly, the northwest wind blows up. And that wind will sail them south along the coast of Greece on their way back to Egypt. And indeed, when they effect their escape, most of the ships that leave are able to escape from Octavian's men because they've got their sails up and they can catch the breeze while the enemy cannot. But that's what they're going to do if necessary. If possible, they want to try to win the battle by ramming the enemy's ships. So early in the morning, the two fleets man their ships. They hear their exhortation from their commanders, and they line up. Antony and Cleopatra's ships are lined up close to the shore, about a half mile in from the shore. And it's quite a long line. It'll be 2 miles or so long. Hmm. On the other side is Octavian and Agrippa's fleet. They're about a nautical mile away from the enemy. So they're keeping their distance. And that means that the enemy cannot... the enemy will have to do a significant row in order to get to them, in order to charge them. We figure that they're manning their ships by 6 in the morning and that the two fleets are in position by around 10 a.m. But it's probably not until the early afternoon that the fighting actually begins, because Antony and Cleopatra are waiting for the wind to blow up when they know that they can escape if necessary. So the two fleets grapple. Antony is not able to effect a successful charge against the enemy. He's not able to ram a significant number of enemy ships. The two fleets are grappling. Cleopatra's squadron of 60 ships has been kept in reserve in the rear. And suddenly, she takes these ships And she makes to break out through the end center of the line and head. She heads westward and then heads south. The Romans are stupefied. They do nothing to stop her. I believe it's because they really didn't expect. They didn't think that a woman and an Egyptian was capable of doing this. They thought the real battle was going to be with Antony and his men. So Cleopatra and her ships are able to escape. At this point, Antony leaves his men. He leaves his flagship. He goes on to a smaller ship and joins up with Cleopatra's flagship and is on this ship as they sail south to safety. All of Cleopatra's 60 ships escape. Not many of Antony's ships escape, maybe a dozen or so escape. And he's able to pick up maybe a dozen or so additional ships as they head south. They head first to Cape Tainarin, the central prong of the Peloponnesus. And from there, they sail back to North Africa, to Egypt. The rest of Antony's fleet continues to fight with Octavian. Octavian tries to get them to surrender. Octavian's frustrated. He realizes, or probably whether he realizes or not, he learns soon enough that he has not taken Cleopatra's treasure. I think he realizes it fairly early on in the battle because of what he does next. When the enemy ships do not surrender, he attacks them with fire arrows. These are going to destroy the ships and kill the men. He would never have done that if he thought that he could still get his hands on Cleopatra's treasure. For him, Cleopatra's treasure is not a luxury. He needs it. Hmm. He needs to pay his men. If he can't pay his men, they're going to rebel. And so he is by no means assured of remaining top dog in Rome in spite of this victory. So from one point of view, Antony and Cleopatra have successfully negotiated a breakout battle. Very difficult thing to do militarily to effect a successful retreat.
But they've lost all or most of their army?
Lost most of their army and their navy. They've lost all of their army and most of their navy. It's going to be probably impossible for them to rebuild a competitive force, and they know it. But they can perhaps rebuild something. Now, Antony might justify it in his own mind that he's lived to fight again another day, but he has certainly violated the rules of Roman honor. Roman manhood and Roman honor would insist that Antony stay with his men and fight and die, or fight and surrender. But he doesn't. He leaves his men to fend for themselves, and he goes off with Cleopatra. That looks really bad. It looks really bad. He's not the first to do this. Pompey left his army and went off to try to fight again another day. Of course, it didn't end very well for him.
Yes, it didn't last. He also went off to Egypt. But I'm just trying to think if I think that's a fair comparison, or whether I've been taken in by Octavian propaganda, where I see Antony, you know, sort of chasing after his consort in a cowardly way. Is Pompey any better? I sort of never held it against Pompey, and I did hold it against Antony. And I'm trying to see if...
Why is Pompey any better?
Well, exactly. This is what I'm trying. I suppose because there were more Republican armies, he might reasonably... I don't know. Maybe there's no difference.
Sure.
Maybe there's no difference.
No, I mean, there were more Republican armies, and unlike Antony and Cleopatra, Pompey still has the fleet. Caesar has no fleet to speak of at the time of the Battle of Pharsalus. And the Republicans do have a fleet, and they do have other armies. So there is that. But Pompey's not sticking around to go down with his men.
That's for sure. okay, so Antony and Cleopatra are back in Alexandria. And I guess, you know, we can probably finish the story reasonably quickly, because Actium is well, you know, it's quite interesting. Perhaps Methone is the key event when the supply lines are disrupted and Antony's army is you know, eventually paralyzed. But Actium is the big event. But do you want to just sort of finish off the story in Egypt?
Sure. So Cleopatra is, she hasn't given up, and she tries to build a new fleet that will sail the Red Sea to India. Egypt and India had trading relations. And she was willing to go off lock, stock, and barrel and start again in India, out of the clutches of the Romans. But she had made enemies with the Nabataean Arabs, and they burned the ships, thereby endearing themselves to Octavian. There are rumors that she and Antony also talked about going off to Spain and making that a redoubt in Spain and fighting the Romans in the very rugged terrain of Spain. There have been lots of precedent for guerrilla actions against the Romans in Spain, but that never happens either. Antony is hoping that he can rally the legions that are still in Egypt. Egypt is very defensible. It is very hard to invade Egypt by land. It has natural barriers in the east and the west, and they're very well fortified. Unfortunately for Antony, though, the armies defending those two fortresses surrender to Octavian in the east, almost certainly because Cleopatra has ordered them to surrender to Octavian. She wants to save herself and she wants to save her children. And that becomes her priority at this point.
I mean, you mentioned the possibility of a flight to Egypt. And I must say, even if my fleet had been burned, I would have taken a single ship and headed off to India quite happily. And particularly the thing that puzzled me was that I would have sent Caesarion off. If I did anything, I would send Caesarion off in advance, because if it turns out well, you can bring him back. If it turns out badly, if she cares about her son, I would have sent him off to India. But they hesitate too long, don't they?
Well, in fairness to them, it's not a slam dunk that that Octavian is going to come and get them. For one thing, he has to deal with a rebellion in the winter of 31-30. There's a mutiny in Italy of soldiers who want to get paid. And he has to make a dangerous naval sea voyage back to Italy in the winter. He almost dies. He runs into a storm, and at least one of his ships is destroyed in the storm, but he makes it. Imagine how different things would have been if he had died in the storm. And knowing Cleopatra, I'm sure, well, we have no ancient evidence for this whatsoever. I'm going to speculate. I wouldn't be surprised if she was trying to assassinate him. And I'm sure she and Antony were doing everything they could to try to build up a resistance. As far as going off to India, I don't think it would have been very wise for her to go off to India without an army to defend her. She would have been a very valuable hostage. And the minute she got there, if I'd been an Indian king, I would have said, "Hey, I'm going to sell you back to Octavian." Why would he do anything other than that? So it's not safe for her to go without an army. And she really did care about her kids and the dynasty. And she may have felt that her best bet was to negotiate with Octavian and try to save what she could. She knew she couldn't save Caesarion. Octavian, remember, he calls himself Gaius Julius Caesar. He can't allow Caesar's real birth child to survive. He has to kill him. So she does send him off to India, but it's too late, as you say. There she has hesitated too long, and he is betrayed. And that's surely what would have happened to her if she'd gone off alone to India. But she does manage to save her other three children. And although only one of them grows to adulthood, it's to a very successful adulthood. She becomes the queen of Numidia and Mauritania, and rules over a very successful court there.
And you want to tell our listeners who it is that brings up Cleopatra's children?
Yes. Cleopatra's children are shipped off to Rome, and they are brought up by none other than Antony's divorced wife, Octavia. She brings them up on the Palatine Hill. The boys never make it to adulthood, and although we can never rule out poison, they might have been killed. They might have died in any number of childhood diseases. But the girl does make it to adulthood. She becomes Queen Cleopatra Selene. As I said, she rules in North Africa very successfully.
Amazing story. So now we get into Shakespeare territory, where Antony, what's left of his army, is finally defeated. And he does the Roman thing, doesn't he?
Yes, he commits suicide. It's a failed job. He doesn't kill himself eventually. It takes him a while to die, but he does die in Cleopatra's arms. And then Octavian enters Alexandria, and though Cleopatra has tried to defend herself and her treasure in her mausoleum, which is turned into a fortress, she is outfoxed by one of Octavian's allies, who gets inside the fortress, and she has to surrender. Octavian gets what he wanted, Egypt's treasure, and now he also has Cleopatra in his hands. Eventually, the two of them meet. It's got to be one of the most dramatic and interesting meetings of two people in all of the ancient world. If only we had been a fly on the wall. All we have is the stories that were reported back to ancient sources, and that are, we get second or third or fourth hand in Plutarch and Cassius Dio. They disagree about some things, but they agree on the essential. That Cleopatra threw herself on Octavian's mercy and nothing doing. Allegedly, he wants her to come back to Rome with him to march in his triumph and be humiliated. There are all sorts of reasons to think that what he really wanted was for her to leave the scene. If he had brought her back to Rome, there would have been pressure to keep her alive, and that would have been a real problem for him. And executing the queen of another country, not such a great thing that for the effective king of Rome to do. Monarchs don't like executing each other. So it's very convenient for Octavian that Cleopatra leaves the scene. The ancient sources insist that she committed suicide, although they agree that they're not sure whether she committed suicide by a snake bite or through poison. Some of my colleagues say neither one. Octavian actually murdered her and then retailed the story of her suicide, but there is zero ancient evidence for that. That is simply modern speculation. As far as that snake bite, it depends which expert you speak to. I spoke to a colleague of mine who's a herpetologist, who is confident that Cleopatra could have been killed by a snake, say a cobra. There are other herpetologists who would tell you with equal confidence that's not possible. Not being a herpetologist myself, I couldn't really weigh in.
I'm pretty sure cobra bites can be deadly. I mean, that's what I've always been told.
I think so, but I don't know. But either a cobra, some say a viper. The ancient sources just say a snake, so we don't know what kind of snake. Or poison, because she had experimented on prisoners in Alexandria. Alexandria was the medical capital of the ancient world, by the way. Ancient Egypt always was. And along with Pergamum in Western Anatolia, those are the two great medical centers. So she experimented supposedly as to what was the most painless way to die. So she might have taken poison. We don't know. But in any case, she is out of the picture in August of the year 30 BC.
And it's ironic that one of the most intelligent, one of the most gifted of the Ptolemies should be the last of them.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's really, it is ironic. It's tragic in its way, yeah.
Okay, well, I think that's, as always with Roman history, it never ends, but that's as good a place to end today's podcast, I think, as anywhere. So Barry, thank you so much indeed for taking the time to talk to me today.
It was a pleasure. You're very welcome.
Well, that's the end of today's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, then I have a big favor to ask. I don't look to make any money from the podcast. There's no advertising or anything like that. I just do this because I enjoy speaking to the guests. And, you know, I'm keen for them to get as big an audience as possible because I think, you know, they are really, really good people. So if you could share it on whatever social media channel you use, tweet it out, whatever it is. And even better, if you could leave a review on iTunes, that would be absolutely fantastic. Anyway, goodbye for now.